This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, is traveling this week. Coming up, it's been 75 years since Americans first got a national minimum wage. 48,000 Americans still die every year from lack of health insurance. And welfare in the United States now reaches very few of those families that really need assistance. But first, people's lawyer Lynn Stewart continues to fight for compassionate release from prison, where she's serving a 10-year sentence for zealously defending her client. Stewart is suffering stage 4 breast cancer, but the Obama administration has turned down all of her pleas to be released to her family and doctors. In Birmingham, Alabama, we spoke with David Yespass, a former president of the National Lawyers Guild.
Our initial position was she never should have been convicted in the first place and certainly should not have gotten the kind of draconian sentence she did. But beyond that, I think even under the old guidelines, she was entitled to compassionate release given the severe nature of her health and the cost to the government to have to provide care that would otherwise be provided with her family at home. And given the new guidelines, I think the only possible reason not to release her would be just pure vindictiveness.
Lynn Stewart suffering stage 4 breast cancer certainly is no danger to anybody's community.
And she was never much of a danger to begin with, other than the fact that she was a really vigorous advocate for the client she represented. At this point, she can't practice law because of the conviction. There is nothing that could cause any harm by her release and an enormous amount of harm that could be caused by her staying in prison.
Lynn Stewart is in prison because she was a zealous defender of her client.
That's exactly right.
Isn't that the lawyer's job?
Absolutely. And I think her prosecution was a warning to defense lawyers that they should not do their jobs as vigorously as they are required constitutionally to do, particularly in cases involving allegations of so-called terrorism.
So zealotry in defense of a Wall Street firm is quite all right.
That's exactly right. Or in defense of police officers. It seems that the only pro-criminal defense rulings that we get from judges these days are for members of Congress and police officers.
Have you seen a chill among the ranks of progressive-leaning attorneys?
On the contrary, I think that for most people who have seen this, it's sort of redoubled their efforts not to be intimidated. I think that as much as that was what the government's aim was, I just don't think they succeeded in. And I think that the outpouring of support for Lynn during the course of her trial and since then really indicates that people who are advocates for the poor and the disenfranchised are not going to be intimidated and are going to continue to struggle. And I think that's particularly evident in the Guantanamo cases and the work that the defense lawyers have done there.
Lynn Stewart's case is as political as you get, and I guess the decision not to allow her compassionate release was determined at the highest political levels.
Undoubtedly. You know, if this were a routine case, I think that under the circumstances, compassionate release would have been almost automatic. Of course, this administration has been particularly unwilling to show any compassion to anyone convicted of a crime. So it's on some levels not shocking that they're not going to stick their necks out for Lynn, because they won't do it for people getting 50 years for selling an ounce of marijuana or something.
Yes, in terms of administrations, how does this one rank on the compassionate scale?
I'd say at the bottom. This administration has yet to pardon a single convict, and I think that's probably a first, given particularly now when people are talking about how draconian and counterproductive these mandatory minimum sentences are for drug offenses, especially the fact that this administration refuses to even consider releasing people who have been low-level involvement in drug transactions and have gotten these absurdly long sentences is just indicative of either just meanness or political cowardice.
So in terms of law and order administrations, this Obama administration could be categorized as the most law and order in our memory.
Yes, if one wants to consider law and order as being locking more people up for longer periods of time, I suppose. And they've also deported more undocumented immigrants than anyone in history. And, you know, the attacks on the administration for not doing enough are just so frivolous under those circumstances. They've been terrible about it.
Attorney David Yespass in Birmingham, Alabama. A nationwide day of protest is planned later this month against the U.S. criminal justice system in all its repressive aspects. Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network explains.
October 22nd is the national day of protest to stop police brutality, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. I was a co-founder of it back in 1996. This year will be the 18th annual National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality. And if anything, it is even more relevant today than it was when we founded it to take on the nationwide epidemic of police brutality, police murder, and the criminalization of the youth. I say that because let's just look at the events over the past summer. The lynching verdict in the case of Trayvon Martin, where the court ruled that George Zimmerman could racially profile, stalk, confront, and murder Trayvon and get away scot-free from it because he was a young black man who Zimmerman had every right to think was a criminal. Now, that takes us back 150 years and more to the Dred Scott decision when black people were ruled by the U.S. Supreme Court to have no rights that white people were bound to respect. I mean, that was just an open declaration of putting a bullseye on the backs of black and brown youth in this society. And I know that there are a whole lot of people who were outraged by that, who questioned the injustice of this setup. And you should question the injustice of a setup that legitimates treating our young people like criminals, guilty until proven innocent, if they can survive to prove their innocence. But we can't just be outraged and questioning. One is we got to get rid of the system. We need a revolution to get rid of it. And we need determined resistance against this outrage. And we can come back up to this past week and see other outrages that need to drive us to take to the streets. One being, the word came out that they overturned the conviction of the cops who, during Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, murdered people on the Danziger Bridge and covered up those murders. And a U.S. federal court overturned those convictions, not because they found any evidence that pointed to the fact that the cops had not murdered people and covered over the convictions. Their justification for overturning the convictions of these murdering cops was that the prosecutors who got them convicted were on Twitter commenting on the case anonymously and saying things like, these five cops should have never gotten a badge in the first place. Now, I have to ask that judge, are you saying those five cops should get badges? That those are the kind of people who should be police officers? And if you aren't, then what's wrong with a prosecutor saying that on Twitter? You know, you actually really get a sense of this system and how it works, because the same courts that will say that have already said it's fine for a prosecutor to lie to a regular defendant who is most often black or Latino in order to trick them into confessing, whether those confessions are correct or not, in order to try to get off with a light sentence. But that same prosecutor can't get on Twitter and say that a murdering cop shouldn't have gotten a badge.
All black folks may have a sense of how the system works, but we don't have data. Tabulations are not kept on the number of black folks who fall victim to police brutality. And in fact, the effort by the Malcolm X grassroots movement to keep a running tally is only a little more than a year old.
The government does not keep and publish a running tally of what it does because it doesn't want the reality of police murder and police abuse to be known by the public. But there have been grassroots efforts. The most recent one is the one by the Malcolm X grassroots movement, which has found that every 28 hours, this is what they have documented, every 28 hours, police kill a black person. And from the work of the Stolen Lives Project of the October 22nd Coalition, that coalition has documented that those killed by police, more than 50% of them were unarmed and involved in no criminal activity when they were killed. They are overwhelmingly youth and more than 85% black or Latino. This is the reality that we're dealing with, and people had to document this on a grassroots basis because it is not an isolated incident when police murder somebody. It is something that happens all the damn time. And the only way it's going to stop is if people from the grassroots stand up and say no more and resist these injustices.
And in fact, every urban rebellion since 1935 has been sparked by instances of police brutality. But we don't see the confrontation between police and especially young black men in the streets being a high priority of the traditional black civil rights organizations.
Yes, and see, that reflects that those civil rights organizations from way back in the 1960s when there was a split in the black movement have been focused on how do positions within the system as it is get opened up so that a few more black people can get in. And that does not get you to the heart of the problem that we're dealing with. Because the heart of the problem is that black people have been viciously exploited from the time the first African was dragged to these shores in slave chains, first as slaves, then as sharecroppers on some of the same plantations where they had been enslaved, and then as the bottom of the workforce in the urban areas across the country post-World War II. What we're facing today is that manufacturing that drew black people out of the South and into the factories has now gone halfway around the world, and there are millions of black and Latino youth growing up in inner cities that have been stripped of legitimate means to survive and raise families. The educational system has been wrecked by the cutbacks in the social service net, and their response is criminalization and imprisonment, and a strategy on the part of these mainstream civil rights movements to construct a new civil rights movement to open up a few more positions is going to leave those tens of millions of youth with no future and no hope. That's why what has to be brought forward is a movement for revolution to get rid of this system, ultimately, and right now, a movement of mass determined resistance. And October 22nd is exactly a great focal point for that because it speaks to the reality for tens of millions of young people and also not so young people, because when you talk about stop and frisk in New York, while the majority of blacks and Latinos stopped and frisked were young. I talked with a 67-year-old grandfather who was with his two under 5-year-old grandchildren when he got stopped and frisked by the police, who claimed they were in hot pursuit of somebody who had held up a bodega. And that's an odd criminal gang, you know, a 67-year-old and two toddlers. That ain't how they usually roll. And what they were basically saying to him is, you're black and we can do whatever we want to you and there's nothing that you can do about it. And we have to say there is something that we can do about it. We can come together. We can stand up against this abuse that law enforcement brings down. And people need to get hooked up. If you're in a city where something is planned for October 22nd, join into it, help build it up. If you're in a city where nothing is going on, then plan something. I've done an interview, which is in Revolution Newspaper, which people can access by going to the website, revcom.us or the stopmassincarceration.net website. People are going to be making plans. That's why I'm really stressing people need to check out the plans, but also get in touch, because we will connect you with people in your area if something is already planned. If nothing is planned, we will get you organizing material so you can start something.
Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, speaking from New York. In Baltimore, the local workers' assembly is preparing to celebrate the anniversary of the National Minimum Wage Law, passed 75 years ago. Organizer Karen Black says the assembly will mark the occasion with a Workers' Demand a Raise Day.
There was a vote and consensus to call on people nationally to support us in an effort to make October 24th a day to say, raise workers' wages, we deserve better. We're actually calling for a $15 an hour minimum wage. Not that we don't deserve more than that, but we decided on the $15 an hour based on solidarity with a movement that's already sparked the interest of a lot of people that the fast food workers have been engaged in. So we think it's particularly important for us in Baltimore and Maryland, where 25% of the folks live in poverty here in this city, and many of them who work, who simply cannot survive on $7.25 an hour.
Real wages for working people haven't risen in decades, and in some cases have fallen.
Right. Actually, the president of the AFL-CIO of Maryland and Washington, D.C., Fred Mason, stated very eloquently at this meeting that if wages had kept up with the cost of living since the first minimum wage was enacted, it'd actually be $15.23.
President Obama made lots of promises when he ran for his first term about raising the minimum wage significantly, but did very little to effectuate that in his first term.
That's absolutely true. In fact, none of the politicians have really done much to help people on the ground, whether employed or unemployed. And I just want to add that we see this demand as important to even those who are unemployed, which is a major problem in this city, in Baltimore. I mean, we're really demanding that they raise the minimum wage so that everyone can have a job at decent wages, not, you know, mass incarceration and jails. But back to your question on President Obama, you're absolutely correct, and it's problematic. That's why we formed, in part by we formed a workers' assembly, is to really get a movement growing on the ground that can force these issues, whether through mass protests, sit-ins, all the different occupations, all the different efforts that we could win our rights on these issues.
We see a lot more union activity working with grassroots organizations these days.
Yes, absolutely. A number of us, a couple of us were actually out at the AFL-CIO convention in Los Angeles a little over a week ago, and it was right after our workers' assembly. And some of the things are very encouraging and very interesting, them including workers' associations like the Domestic Workers Association, the taxi drivers. That's all good. But as most of us feel, you know, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and we feel that community and grassroots organizations can do a lot to encourage the union movement to go in that kind of direction where it becomes a more inclusive movement, something that can address the issue of all workers, whether they are in unions or not.
And what about the traditional civil rights organizations? Have they put these economic issues high enough in terms of their priorities?
Well, here locally, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference is part of this effort. And we'll see. We'll see about that question, Mr. Ford. We'll see if they'll come on board on October the 24th. Hopefully they do. Part of it is that I think that too many organizations have relied on the old traditional framework of things, that is, the Democratic Party, you know, they're very wedded to that, and that's somewhat problematic. But having said that, I think that it varies from state to state, a variety of organizations. For instance, in North Carolina, Moral Mondays is being led by the NAACP there, and they've been doing a tremendous job of mobilizing people and getting them out in the streets and trying to fight these incredible right-wing attacks that have been going on in that area of the country. So I think it varies from place to place who's involved in this actual fight.
And what's going to be happening October 24th?
We just put out our call just the other day, and we're getting feedback from people around the country. In Baltimore, we had a follow-up meeting, and organizers decided to really take on the entire day. For instance, we're going to be going to some of the places where a lot of workers work in sweatshops. There's still a lot of factory work here that's very, very low wage. And we're going to be petitioning workers there. And then at around noontime, we're going to have a major press conference and then a major action at rush hour at 4 o'clock. We're going to be planning a march from Lexington Market. It's an area where a lot of low-wage workers work, and then we'll be marching to the Inner Harbor, which is another place where the issue of low wages is very critical. In New York City, people have already launched a decision to have demonstrations at Herald Square. So it's growing, and I think in about a week we'll have sort of the outline of what's taking place around the country and who's doing what. We should view October 24th as part of an ongoing campaign. And part of it is there's been this very good work going on in the ground around fast food organizing that a number of unions have spearheaded, you know, and also around our Walmart, which we've worked closely with our Walmart workers. But what we're hoping to do is broaden it to make these issues political issues and to address the concerns of workers everywhere. Now, that may be something that grew out of the concrete here in Baltimore City and in Maryland, where union density is very low, about 3%, and the unions haven't been able to get very far here. But the problems are intense, and at each meeting we had people come and testify. The first meeting, everybody, we had even musicians come and talk about how they were abused by club owners. We had people come and tell us how they were only making $8 an hour and how they couldn't afford to support their families and how they were living in poverty. We had a lot of young workers talk about, especially Black and Latino youth who go through college hoping that they're going to get something out of it and end up being dishwashers. That's like a major problem here. And last night at our meeting, EMS workers who were working for companies here are ripping people off. We're making $10.25 an hour. So it's sort of a problem that spans not just the fast food workers who are hoping to show a different kind of support than just what they're doing on their own, but all the workers, at least here in this city. Poverty level here is intense. And it's not that people aren't working. People are working. I mean, there's also a lot of joblessness, of course. You know, like 56% of the youth in Baltimore City, because of racism and all sorts of other reasons, have no jobs. But there is no incentive either when you can't, you know, you're going to be working for $7.25 or $8.25 an hour at some fast food place or as a dishwasher. We need to fight for decent wages for everybody.
Well, what job recovery there is in the low-wage sector.
Yes. It's not just a phenomena that impacts people in cities like Baltimore and Detroit. I was able to go out to Bentonville after our Poor People's Campaign. We had voted that we would send a delegation out to join our Walmart workers. And while I've known this, and I think we all know it, to actually see it and feel it, almost all of the workers in this country now are low wage. The people who aren't feeling it may be a small minority who still have some union benefits or may have gotten some skills, and they're just not really in touch with how people in Ohio are living. I remember being on a tour, and this whole state is devastated across this demographics. People are just suffering in this country, and the wages have been lowered for everybody. I mean, that's probably part of the problem with the union density being so low, is that once the union density is so low, it means that wages are down for everybody. And that's what is actually increasing low-wage work, whether it's in the big box stores or even there's still a lot of sweatshop shops in terms of factories and a lot of offices. Wages have been pushed down for everyone, and no one is really talking a lot about it. Same thing with the lack of health care and what that means.
Karen Black of the Baltimore Workers Assembly. According to a study by Physicians for a National Health Plan, 48 million Americans still lack access to health insurance, and 48,000 of them die every year because of it. Dr. David Himmelstein conducted the study.
It's a terrible indictment of our healthcare system. I mean, we spend more than any other nation, and yet we're the only wealthy nation that doesn't cover everybody, and there are nearly 50,000 people dying because of that fact each year. We could have the best healthcare system in the world. For what we're spending, we ought to have the best healthcare system in the world. But billions and billions are drained out of the healthcare system by greedy corporations, by insurance companies that basically their interest is in denying people care and denying people coverage. And as a result, we've got 48 million people still without coverage. And even if Obamacare works as planned, we're still going to have 31 million people who won't have coverage after the Obama plan is fully implemented. So even if everything works out as we hope it will with Obamacare, we're still going to be the worst in the whole developed world.
And yet, with the political dialogue in this country, people seem to assume it's Obamacare or nothing.
Well, I think we need to get on to the next stage of reform, and I'm old enough to remember that we've been through very bleak times in the past, and yet we came out of them. So when I was a kid in the 1950s, it didn't look like we were going to be able to make much progress, and when I was a teenager in the 1960s, things changed a lot. So yes, at the moment, it doesn't really look like we're going to be able to move very fast, very far, but that can change in a hurry, and we're very hopeful that it will change.
How would Medicare for All work? That's the proposal that you put forward.
Well, it's a simple system. It says basically, instead of having 1,500 different private insurance companies, each with its own paperwork and costly overhead, we expand the Medicare program to cover everybody and improve it, upgrade it, so that it's simpler and more effective. So Medicare at this point takes only about 2% of every dollar, 2 cents of every dollar for its administration. The average private insurer is taking 12 cents of every dollar. So just by saying we're going to use Medicare to administer the coverage, we get something like $100 billion back that we can invest in care. And it says to people, you don't have to worry when you change jobs, what happens to your insurance, or if you're unemployed, what happens to your insurance. Everybody is covered. Everybody gets a card at the time when they're born, or their parents get a card that guarantees them lifetime coverage no matter what happens. And we pay for it out of taxes in a simple way. And estimates have been made not just by me but by a subsidiary of the biggest private insurance company that says that could cover everyone for less than we're now spending on health care and give everyone terrific coverage, better coverage than most people have today.
Has Medicare been strengthened or weakened by the existence of the president's legislation?
Probably not much change in Medicare with the president's legislation. They were careful to leave it alone. They took some of the money away from the private HMOs that have been gouging Medicare, but frankly, in the interim, some legislation was passed. After they took it away with the right hand, they gave it back with the left hand. So we're back about where we were in 2010 with Medicare.
In 2009, there seemed to be a critical mass of support, certainly in the House, for some kind of single payer. What's the political outlook in the Congress today?
Well, we still have many dozens of supporters in the House for a single-payer Medicare for All system. And in fact, if anything, we think the sentiment is going to be strengthening there. Not only that, but for the first time this year, we're going to have a real single-payer in the Senate, first time in many years. Senator Sanders is going to introduce the bill, and we understand that there are going to be a number of co-sponsors in the Senate. And Harry Reid even said in a statement when he was talking to his constituents that he thinks we ought to be moving towards single payer. So we're not there yet. We're not about to pass it this year, certainly with a Republican majority in the House. But there is a strong group of supporters, even in Washington. And for most things, Washington is the last place to know.
President Obama used to talk as if his bill was a step towards a single payer kind of situation in the future. Is that true, or is this an effort to preserve the relationship of the private insurance companies?
Well, unfortunately, his plan has really, if anything, strengthened the private insurance companies. I mean, the federal government is dumping hundreds of billions of dollars in new revenues into private insurance companies as part of this plan. And unfortunately, they'll use that money to fight tooth and nail against single-payer plans. So I can't say that Obama plan is a step towards single-payer. If anything, it strengthened the private insurance companies. On the other hand, you know, Winston Churchill once said that you can always rely on Americans to do the right thing after they've exhausted every other possibility. So maybe the Obama plan is a step in terms of exhausting the other possibilities.
Dr. David Himmelstein of Physicians for a National Health Plan. Poverty rates remain much higher than they were before the economic meltdown of 2008. Timothy Casey is senior staff attorney for Legal Momentum, which used to be called the National Organization for Women, Defense, and Educational Fund. Casey says poverty is most severe among women and children, but the federal program called Temporary Assistance to Needy Families is inadequate to the task.
The program needs to be made more accessible. Right now, 2 out of 3 families and children who are eligible don't get into the program, don't get any benefits, number one, so we have to make the program more accessible to our poor families. And secondly, we need to raise the benefit level. Benefits in every state are far below the official poverty level, which is about $19,000 a year for a family of 3. So benefits are typically less than half the official poverty level. So we need to make the program more accessible, and we need to raise benefit levels at least to the poverty level.
Well, isn't it inaccessible by design? That is, they don't want people applying for the program.
I think that's largely true. Welfare reform to many who came to administer the program means not providing assistance to poor families, leaving them to try to get by on their own, even though jobs are often not available, or if they are available, child care is not available.
Yes, tell us about welfare reform. It's been touted by lots of Democrats of the Clinton and Obama variety as being a great success because so many people were removed from the rolls.
Again, it would have been a success if the reason people were not getting assistance was because they had jobs and were no longer poor. Unfortunately, that's not the main reason that the welfare rolls have gone down. The main reason the welfare rolls have gone down is because the program has stopped serving many poor families. When welfare reform started in 1996, over 3 out of 4 poor families, poor kids, were receiving assistance, and now it's down to only about 25%. So the major reason the welfare rolls have gone down is because fewer poor families are getting any benefits. It's not because there's less poverty.
Isn't this inaccessibility part of the reason that so fewer are getting the benefits?
Absolutely, yes. There are administrative barriers. The agencies that administer the program make it difficult to apply. And if you do apply and do start receiving assistance, they make it difficult to continue to receive assistance. There are just all sorts of barriers. The application forms are incredibly long. Sometimes people may not speak English. They don't get the required assistance. Sometimes they ask for forms of verification that are simply unavailable, and the applications are denied because they can't get the document that's simply not available.
So the idea seems to be that if you can create a program that poor people will not apply for, then poverty can be said to be just fading away.
The standard should be how many families are being taken out of poverty. And welfare reform has largely been a failure because we still have millions of poor families. We're not receiving any assistance at all.
And now we see House Republicans trying to put work requirements and drug testing on food stamps.
Well, there actually are work requirements in food stamps and have been for many, many years. What they're calling work requirements isn't really work requirements, but they're trying to impose a rule that not that you must be willing to work, but that you must actually have a job. And there's a real difference between being willing to work and looking for work and not being able to find one and getting assistance. And people being told, even if you're willing to work and you're searching for work but you can't find a job, then they're not going to aid you. So that's not really a work requirement. That's just a new rule to exclude people who are looking for work but can't find a job.
So in other words, the unemployed would not be eligible for food stamps, but those with jobs would be.
Yes, and that would be the point of the change. So if you're unemployed and you're not caring for minor children, basically the intent of the proposed change is to say that you must have a job, otherwise you're not going to get assistance. The exceptions would include those people who are disabled or aged or who are caring for minor children. But people did not fit into those categories. I would largely be told that unless you have a job, you won't be able to get food stamps in more than a few months. And right now we know that in the average case, unemployment can last many, many more months than 3 months.
And what do you think the intent of the framers of that legislation is?
Well, I don't like to speculate as to the intent, but it seems to me if you just look at the consequences of what's being proposed, the effect of what's being proposed is that the people who are needy and unemployed would be left with that in essential benefit they need to feed themselves.
Timothy Casey of Legal Momentum. 6 million people have died since 1996 when Rwanda and Uganda invaded the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo. A United Nations intervention brigade has been fighting so-called rebels armed and financed by Rwanda. We spoke with Maurice Carney, Executive Director of Friends of Congo.
The intervention brigade has had really two effects. One is political and the second is military. As it relates to the political effect, it has heightened the stakes in the sense that both M23, the Rwanda-backed M23, and the Rwandan government have been trying to use the political landscape, especially Rwanda's presence on the UN Security Council at the UN, to protect the M23, knowing that it's facing an increased military threat from the intervention brigade. As it relates to the military landscape, both the Congolese military and the United Nations itself have been emboldened with this offensive mandate. However, I have to quickly add that the intervention brigade is really not the optimum way to deal with the situation in the East. And in fact, it is, as we see it as an alternative, has come about as a result of the lack of political will on the part of the United States, on the part of the United Nations, to deal forcefully in the diplomatic arena with both Rwanda and Uganda. So we have a situation where the U.S., the U.N., pursuing the least effective path to appear to be addressing the conflict while leaving the structural forces in place that are at the root of the conflict, primarily longtime U.S. allies, Rwanda and Uganda, and their support for proxy militia inside of the Congo.
Yes, to what extent has the United States applied real sanctions and diplomatic pressure and all the different kinds of pressures that a superpower can bring to bear against Rwanda, its client?
It just hasn't. When you compare it to the way the U.S. has acted against Zimbabwe or the way it's beating the war drums against Syria, when you look at the magnitude of the tragedy in the Congo, the United Nations says it's the deadliest conflict in the world since World War II, where millions of Congolese have lost their lives. The U.S. just hasn't brought any substantial weight whatsoever. When President Obama was last in Africa, in Tanzania, he was asked a question by a reporter about what the U.S. is doing about its allies in the region, and they're destabilizing the Congo. President Obama responded and said that Congo's neighbors need to stop supporting militia groups inside of the Congo. What was notable in his response was that he didn't even mention Rwanda and Uganda. He didn't mention their names. Everybody knew who he was talking about, which countries, but the fact that he didn't mention their names gives you some insight into the type of policy that the Obama administration has been pursuing as it relates to its allies and their involvement in the deadliest conflict in the world since World War II. They've been pursuing what the State Department calls quiet diplomacy, which basically, for all intents and purposes, result in near carte blanche for U.S. allies to do as they please in the east of the Congo.
Sounds like the coup that could not be called a coup in Egypt.
Somewhere along those lines, absolutely. And that's what we're pushing the administration, especially in light of the fact that President Obama himself passed a bill into law when he was senator that calls for the United States to hold its allies accountable, authorizes the Secretary of State to withhold aid from neighboring countries that destabilize the Congo. So we see the United States really faced with a dilemma where it has laws on its books, the evidence is overwhelming of its allies destabilizing the Congo, sponsoring war criminals, and many of the war criminals, or the leadership of the war criminals that's on U.S. sanctions list, but yet the United States has yet to put any of the high-level officials, either in Rwanda or Uganda, on its sanctions list. The United States has prevented Iran interference at the United Nations and prevented the United Nations from putting on the UN sanctions list those individuals in high-level positions in Rwanda and Uganda that the UN's own research body, a group of experts, says are sponsoring a militia group in the Congo and should be sanctioned.
And our listeners should always be reminded that the Rwanda regime is a minority tribal-based regime.
The Rwandan Patriotic Front, that's Paul Kagame's party and military, Rwanda can be called a military with a state as opposed to a state with a military. I don't know how much I would lean on the ethnicity part, even though they're predominantly Tutsi, what we've seen with Paul Kagame. It's a question of power. And he's as quick to kill any ethnicity as long as it results in his acquiring and maintaining power. And this really speaks to a larger question, Glenn, when we're looking in the region. We're talking about the DR Congo, Uganda, Rwanda. We see that the people are trapped under the leadership of sociopaths, people who are willing to kill at the drop of a hat. And these sociopaths maintain their hold on the people of the region. And the only way they maintain their hold, or the predominant way they maintain their hold on the people of the region, is through the backing of a superpower. They couldn't be doing what they're doing in the Congo, in Rwanda, in Uganda, without the backing of the United States. And these sociopaths are not only supported militarily, not only supported with intelligence, with equipment, with training from the United States, but they're given diplomatic and political cover at the international level, in international forums like the United Nations, and presented to the world as new leaders of Africa. And they have powerful friends at the highest level of government and industry in the West. We're talking about people like former President Bill Clinton, former Prime Minister Tony Blair, one of Warren Buffett's son, Howard G. Buffett. These are some powerful people who are in support of these leaders, especially Paul Kagame, who will be in New York next week with the support of the Jewish community there. So they have powerful friends outside the region, even as they commit heinous crimes in the Congo and the region itself. So the people are trapped in this system, and it's this system that the Congolese and Rwandan, Ugandan people are trying to get out from under.
Not the least of their friends is Susan Rice, President Obama's national security advisor, the former U.S. ambassador to the U.N.
So certainly Susan Rice is among their supporters, former Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Jendai Fraser is also among their supporters, and the current U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power. So they have powerful friends in high places. And it's vital that we expose these connections where these individuals, current and former government officials, continue to support some of the most reprobate and depraved killers that we see on the African continent that have dominion over the masses of the people. And it's vital that we break this bond. President Obama himself, he gives lip service to it when he was in Ghana in 2009, and then again this year when he was in South Africa. He reiterated, he said the United States wants to support strong institutions in Africa and not strong men. And those are good words, but the actions indicate to the contrary, where the U.S. continues to support strong men, and not just strong men who are authoritarian figures, but strong men who are mass killers. And they have the blood of millions of Africans on their hands, and even in the case of Rwanda, United Nations said in its 2010 UN mapping exercise report that Rwanda, if tried in front of a competent court, may be brought up on charges of genocide that is committed in the Congo. So these are very serious matters, and U.S. policy is on the side of the strong man, on the side of the dictators, on the side of the mass killers, and not on the side of nonviolent pro-democracy forces that we find in the region.
South Africa and Rwanda's neighbor, Tanzania, both have troops in the United Nations Intervention Force. How has that affected relations between Rwanda and those two countries?
As you know, the relations between Tanzania and South Africa and Rwanda have been strained over the last few years for several reasons. One, some dissidents from the Rwandan regime got refuge in South Africa. And true to form and practice, Rwanda went after these dissidents and tried to assassinate them on South African soil. So that rankled the South African government and strained the relations between Rwanda and South Africa. Back in May of this year, in Tanzania, said to the both Rwanda and Uganda, listen, you both have militia groups inside of Congo that are your nationals. Instead of carrying on this 17-year war of aggression against the Congolese people under the guise of going after these militia groups, you should engage in a dialogue with them to resolve this matter politically. And this drew the ire of Rwanda's President Paul Kagame, and he basically threatened the Tanzanian President Kikwete and shared with him that he needs to be careful because he might get hit. In the parlance of regional language, that means, you know, we may come after you militarily. So tensions are certainly high among South Africa, Tanzania, and Rwanda. And the Intervention Brigade has just added to those tensions because South African and Tanzanian troops could quite possibly face up against Rwandan troops, seeing that they have been in the Congo, seeing that they're the backers of the M23. And just recently, the SADC nations, the Southern African Development Community nations, of which both South Africa and Tanzania are part of, issued a communique calling on Rwanda to back down as Rwanda has mobilized forces along Congo's border, claiming that shells have fallen into Rwanda, shells that they claim have been fired by the Congolese military, which the United Nations says is not the case. It's the shells that did not come from the Congolese military, even though they did land in Rwandan territory. So the tensions between the SADC nations and Rwanda are the highest that we've seen since the 1998 war. You know, back then when Rwanda and Uganda invaded the Congo for the second time, backed by the United States, it was the SADC nations that came to the rescue of Congo's President Laurent Kabila. It was Zimbabwe and Namibia, Angola, that came in and rebuffed the U.S.-backed invasion of the Congo in 1998.
What should friends of Congo be looking forward to address this problem?
Well, right now, Glenn, it's vital, absolutely vital, that we continue to put pressure on the Obama administration, on Secretary of State John Kerry, to hold its allies accountable. As I shared earlier, Rwanda and Uganda couldn't be doing in the Congo what they're doing without the support of the United States. And even the United States itself has acknowledged the role that Rwanda and Uganda is playing in destabilizing the Congo. So people of goodwill, friends of the Congo, friends of Africa, really need to step up and put pressure on the U.S. administration for it to cease arming, training, financing its allies in the region who are responsible for the deaths of millions of Africans. So it's critical for us to do that at this time. And for people to get engaged around doing that, we encourage them to visit CongoWeek.org, CongoWeek.org, so they can see the actions that they can join in that people throughout the globe are taking to put pressure on the U.S. and the West for them to stop supporting the destabilizing of the Congo by their allies.
That was Maurice Carney of Friends of Congo. The International Criminal Court, or ICC, was supposed to be a neutral prosecutor of crimes against humanity, but has so far brought charges only against Africans. This one-sided form of justice is increasingly rejected on the African continent. Both houses of parliament in Kenya have voted to withdraw from the ICC. John Philpott is a Canadian lawyer, a former secretary of the American Association of Jurists, who has defended clients before the International Criminal Court and other tribunals. Philpott explains why the ICC is no longer welcome in Kenya.
They had an election, and they campaigned, and one of the major aspects of the campaign was, we can handle our problems ourselves, and we don't agree with the ICC. And Mr. Kenyatta, who is a very charismatic man, I actually know him. I also know Mr. Ruto because I was on the case a couple of years ago, ran on that platform with Mr. Ruto, and they won with 50.21% or something like that. But the opposing party, who was resolutely pro-American in every conflict in Africa, Odinga, only got 43%. So it's a very strong result. There was a third person there. And so there was all this tra-la-la about fake ballots and fake cheating. It fell apart. So you have a government who was elected on a policy to not accept the ICC jurisdiction. And the language that which is used, and you have seen it like I have, is neocolonialism, interfering in personal affairs. I know that just after the election, the British ambassador, who was very upset at the result, wanted to meet Mr. Kenyatta, and I know he put it off. He met other embassies and other emissaries and from all over Africa, because Africa is very proud of Kenya and proud of this election. So the logical consequence of it is that the parliament went ahead and decided to withdraw from the ICC, which is a good step because the ICC is the right hand of military political intervention. And everywhere we have, many of the hot places we have seen lately have been coupled with ICC charges. We've had a conflict in the Sudan, and now the president of Sudan, who travels a lot, is trying to go to the States, to the UN, and you've seen in the press now. You see Mr. Gaddafi, who was killed, but just before he was killed, there was charges being against him and his son and in Kenya. And I know we're stepping outside of Africa, we're onto the Mediterranean, and they now want to lay charges against Mr. Assad. So the ICC has no credibility. And we as lawyers know other reasons why there's no credibility is because the quality of the evidence is shoddy. In Canada and probably in the U.S., for many cases, I don't want to whitewash our courts, the evidence can be somewhat convincing. And fabrication of evidence is not totally systematic in our court system, although there are flaws, of course. But in those international courts, the quality of evidence is so bad. You can't get the names of the people. You can't publish anything about it. There's no scrutiny. There's no international scrutiny. There's no parliamentary or political opposition which can influence the charging and the process in the courts. So the ICC is in a very, very bad shape, I think.
So a majority in the Kenyan parliament believed that the ICC had been used as a tool to influence the Kenyan election and to undermine Kenya's sovereignty.
For what it's worth, my friends who are rather well informed say that the ICC charges galvanized Kenya and allowed these people to win because there's so much revulsion towards the ICC. They tried to decapitate the country by charging the potential leaders, Mr. Ruto and Mr. Kenyatta.
If Africa rebels against the ICC, then the ICC is out of business because it only prosecutes Africans.
That's a very good idea. Would it be good? You know, a lot of people would be out of work, and it would be a good thing for Africa.
As long as the United States and the two colonial powers, Britain and France, exercise so much control over the UN, is there the possibility for any kind of just international criminal court apparatus?
The United States has, I think it's called Section 98 agreements with more than 100 countries, which says this country who signed a deal with the States says we will refuse to turn over an American charged with the crime of the ICC. So that's impunity for Americans who are possibly the biggest war criminals and have certainly committed massive crimes in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And in fact, Charles Taylor at the Sierra Leone Tribunal was found guilty of helping the rebels who committed crimes in a neighboring country. He was president of Liberia. Well, is not the U.S. guilty of crimes committed by the so-called rebels which invade Syria? So the U.S. is guilty of crimes on tremendous scale committed by the people who are disrupting and invading Syria. But, of course, they're going to have impunity. France has got soldiers in and around Syria also. So they're vulnerable. And they've signed the ICC. They recognize the ICC, as does Britain. So they exercise a tremendous power in the prosecution. And the Security Council can also stop investigations. It can initiate investigations. In the late 40s, there was a dream of having an international criminal court, which didn't come because of the Cold War, which we know the history. And I think that probably the present International Criminal Court, it's going to stumble along. It'll certainly continue defending the superpowers, and it'll probably end up continue attacking Africans. But the Kenyan case is actually quite important because it was one which was initiated by the prosecutor. He asked the court for permission to start the proceedings. The court agreed. And objectively speaking, it hasn't gone well. They started with six. They now have three left. And two of the accused have been elected, very strongly elected, in Kenya. So the credibility of the international court can depend on the result of the Kenyan case, whether they win or lose and whether the quality of the evidence is bad or good.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda TV. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.